Hi, you're listening to Manufactured, a podcast about sustainability and the making of fashion. I'm your host, Kim van der Weert, a student of human rights, turned garment factory manager, turned sustainable fashion critic. On this show, I talk to some of the most integral people who manufacture what we wear. They aren't the people you see in fashion magazines, they're the people behind closed doors working in fashion supply chains. On the one hand, people often talk about legislation and regulation as if it's the golden ticket out of fashion sustainability problems. The logic goes something like this. The reason, quote-unquote, bad stuff happens in fashion supply chains is because of weak governance, quote-unquote, over there. Therefore, we must hold brands and retailers in the global north legally accountable for their impacts, including throughout their supply chains, primarily in the global south. In other words, those global brands and retailers are filling governance gaps, again, quote-unquote, over there. On the other hand, there's the curious case of apparel production in Leicester. Despite being in the heart of the UK, a quote-unquote developed country and leading superpower that's decidedly not, again, quote-unquote, over there, labor rights abuses in Leicester's garment sector have long been described as an open secret. This mini-series is dedicated to exploring this paradox. How is it possible that, despite strong governance and regulation, labor rights abuses have persisted in Leicester? What are the lessons and implications for our efforts to leverage legislation as a tool to fix fashion's sustainability woes globally? Each episode is a conversation with a different stakeholder group. We talk to a lawyer working on human rights abuses in Leicester, the leader of a local manufacturing association, a policy expert and government official, and a former production worker who, in recent years, has begun working in community engagement. This series has been co-created with Dr. Divya Jyoti, who some of you may remember meeting on the show before. Divya, a sustainability professional in a past life, is now a lecturer in the Department of Organization, Work and Technology at Lancaster University in the UK. She researches issues of ethics and sustainability in fashion supply chains while continuing her work with reform-oriented organizations. This mini-series has been supported by Lancaster University Management School and the Pentland Center for Sustainability in Business at Lancaster University, working in partnership with Justice in Fashion CIC, a UK-based not-for-profit that works to address imbalances of power and resources across the fashion industry supply chain. Last thing, we want this series to generate discussion and to be a two-way conversation. Share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. We're also going to be doing a live virtual conversation on 3 October to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link also in the episode description. In this episode, my co-host Dr. Divya Jyoti and I are in conversation with Jennifer Wasak, a lawyer and the co-founder and managing director of Justice in Fashion, an organization that addresses inequalities of wealth and power in fashion supply chains. Jennifer started her career as a U.S. attorney, working in state and local government. After a long and distinguished career as a lawyer, 8 years ago, in 2016, she shifted her focus to human rights issues, particularly business and human rights, and came to the UK to pursue her MBA. As an attorney turned human rights activist, Jen worked with refugees and migrant populations. At the peak of the pandemic in 2020, following media exposés of the garment industry, Jen's desire to seek justice for the vulnerable eventually brought her to Leicester. Together, we explore the history of apparel production in Leicester, the events that put its labor practices under a global spotlight in the pandemic and before, Jennifer's initial assumptions about how to solve these issues, and how gradually those assumptions changed. Through her own missteps, Jennifer also shares why she now emphasizes the importance of contextual solutions and listening to the people and communities working in apparel production when designing those solutions. I'm really excited to talk to both of you because you both know so much more about Leicester than I do, and I never would have even stumbled on this topic had it not been for you guys. But I want to just kick things off by having you share a little bit about why this is a topic that you think is interesting and relevant to broader conversations about how we might regulate fashion supply chains. And Divya, I'll start with you. Why is Lester an interesting and relevant conversation to have? And then Jennifer, I'll let you build on that.
So as you know, I've been working with the fashion industry. And before I moved into academia, I was in practice and I was working with this organization called Center for Responsible Business, where my role was largely working with brands and various other stakeholders to look at how we can create more ethical factories, how we can strengthen, facilitate, enable ethical production. It was around that time that I decided to do my master's and came to the UK. So I came up to Birmingham, and that's when I first discovered a report, which was by ETI, led by a researcher from the University of Leicester, which looked at the state of play in Leicester's factories. And that really intrigued me because I had come to believe, rather naively at the time, I should say, that all of these issues are actually issues of what you may like to say in quotes, the global south, where the production happens. And that's what I thought is where the problem is. We need to clean up the production supply chain in parts of the world where the legal systems are not as developed, where there are not enough technical capabilities and capacities there. So that was really, really intriguing for me for the first time, I would say. But then I embarked on my PhD journey where I was looking at factory workers and their experiences. And as it happened, very close to the expose during the pandemic, I ended up, and now I think it was almost fated.
You mean the Leicester expose?
Yes, the Leicester expose. I ended up taking up my first academic role in the Montfort University in Leicester, which then enabled an opportunity for me to kind of be in Leicester and meet various stakeholders. And that's how, you know, I ended up meeting Jen and several others. And that's where I think I began posing this question, which is still, I would say, is partly unanswered, or the attempt in this conversation or these series of conversation is to try and arrive at an answer or an explanation on what's really going on, how is it and why is it. And just the point to add there is, when I look at the way we as an industry are trying to tackle a lot of issues, it's almost like we are propagating particular ideas that this is how things should work. And I think the case of Leicester in many ways makes us a little more skeptical about whether the approaches that we are putting forth, would they really work? And if we want them to be functional, then what are the limitations and challenges? And it also in some ways raises bigger questions around just the way the industry is organized and what happens and how capital moves around. So it's a range of those questions, I think, which is what brought me to Leicester in some ways.
And how about you, Jen? Because I know in one of our past conversations, you just said, I just feel like there's so much for the sector to learn from Leicester. Is there anything you want to add to what Divya has shared?
Leicester is a wonderful case study. And just to give you some background as to why it became an area of focus for me, it's sort of a COVID lockdown story. When we were all kind of shut in our houses, and news came out. As a lawyer, I was interested in the brands who were invoking the force majeure clauses to cancel their overseas production orders. And so we started an organization with a couple colleagues in response to kind of figure out we should be doing something because of the impacts that these cancellations of orders were having on workers. Primarily, we were thinking far away workers. And primarily the impacts that that was going to be having on the primarily women who were working in those industries. So Justice in Fashion was started with that kind of mindset that we were going to come together and do something to help address these impacts that were taking place over there. So at that same time, the reports started coming out about the cases of COVID that were spreading in Leicester and the connection with the workers who were continuing to work in the factories when there were lockdowns. And it really drove home that this isn't something that is just happening over there. This is happening here in the UK. I'm American, but I've been living and working in the UK for the past 8 years. So I live relatively close to Leicester, and it was kind of eye-opening for me to have had this preconceived thought that we're forming this organization to help women over there when actually there's a huge issue going on right here in the country where I live.
For people who know nothing about Leicester, the kind of like 101, what do people need to know or understand about apparel production in Leicester? And what was your sort of role within that?
Leicester is a city that's in the Midlands in the UK. It has a strong history of manufacturing and a very proud and strong tradition of particular garment manufacturing. It used to be, Leicester was known as a Leicester closed the world. It was thriving. It employed so many people. It was a huge percentage of the local economy there. It gave a lot of people employment. It lifted people out of poverty. The factories were at capacity producing clothes. And it was a very healthy and strong industry that is a huge, or has been a huge source of pride and an economic driver for that area of the Midlands.
And can you situate us historically a little bit? Like, what period are you talking about?
It started, of course, like with the Industrial Revolution. I would say it reached its height after the Second World War, and probably the last peak that it had was probably in the 1990s. And what you saw at that point was a trend across the world to start outsourcing production to countries where labor was less expensive. And as a result, many of the brands chose not to manufacture in the UK, and that created more competition with the brands that remained and the suppliers that were remaining. And then that, in addition, put pressure on tighter costs, lack of being able to make profits from orders that came through. And all of that necessarily led to, for suppliers to say, how are we going to cut down our costs in order to remain competitive in this market? So I would say for the past two decades, at least, it's been a bit of an open secret in the industry that there has been labor exploitation taking place in the factories, in the Leicester mills. And it is gotten worse the more the production is sent overseas. And also, as a result, there's been more attention focused on the practices that are taking place in Leicester, which is really off-putting to many of the brands who just don't want to have that kind of association.
And can you just expand a little bit on your own involvement? So you painted us a picture. You were living not far from Leicester. You were part of an organization during the pandemic as a lawyer that was trying to look at like these order cancellations in production countries outside of the UK. And then you realized that there were all these issues sort of in your backyard, so to speak. What did your involvement in Leicester's apparel sector look like? What form did that end up taking?
It might be helpful if I gave you a tiny bit of background of my prior life.
Please.
I am a U.S. qualified attorney and for 20 years worked in public law, in local government and in state government in Colorado in the U.S. I always had a strong interest in addressing barriers that exist to, well, access to justice issues. 8 years ago, I decided to make a career change and changed my focus to human rights issues, and particularly business and human rights issues. That was about the time the 2015 UK Modern Slavery Act came into effect. And at the time, I was working for a charity in East London and doing some research with refugees and migrants. And it was very clear that there was a huge connection between vulnerable and exploitable people and their legal status or status as a migrant in the UK. That sort of led, you know, to some work I was doing to try to help businesses develop content and meaningful programs that they could include in their modern slavery statements, which were kind of like transparency statements that they were required, big companies were required to file under the new Modern Slavery Act. More recently, and during initial periods of the lockdown, I spent time in Lesvos in the Moria refugee camp for 4 months, working again with displaced people, migrants, people in very, very dire and extreme circumstances, and could see the direct link between migrant status and the exploitability and the vulnerability that those people have. It was a very interesting, you know, direct experience to observe and to kind of bring into my learnings when I started working in Leicester. to get you up to speed with how I became involved directly in Leicester, as soon as I came back from the camp, there had been a petition filed under Section 307 of the U.S. Tariff Act. It was a petition that contained evidence suggesting that any goods manufactured in Leicester or by Boohoo may be made in whole or in part by forced labor. And that was a significant issue because I was familiar with the law.
So in other words, goods coming from Leicester were stuck in customs in the U.S. and not being let into the country? Is that what you mean?
It was a petition that said there needs to be more investigation to determine whether such a ban should be put in place. So it did hit the news media. It's significant because every other petition that's been filed under this U.S. Tariff Act law has been addressed at companies or industries that are in the Global South. And this was the first one that addressed an industry in the Global North. And as an American and as a lawyer living and working in the U.K., it was thought that I'd been very well positioned to kind of come in and say, what's going on here? What can we do to prevent or to mitigate the impact of an import ban on the factories and the workers that are in Leicester?
And is there anything else you want to share about your work since then that you think might be important or relevant for people to understand or know before we get into the conversation?
I have learned an incredible amount in the past few years since working in Leicester, and it has really been eye-opening and challenged a lot of the assumptions that I had as somebody from a Western developed world looking at it from a lawyer's perspective or legislative perspective, this sort of top-down viewpoint, and being able to see when, as soon as I, you know, parachuted into Leicester and began my work there, what a huge disconnect there was between what those intentions were and the realities on the ground.
Okay. And I can't wait to get into this in more detail with you between, let's say, people's intentions and the constraints that they face is a recurring theme on this show. But Divya, from your side, is there anything from like a contextual point of view that you want to add before we get into that conversation?
I think I do want to kind of share how Jen and I met, because I think it kind of sets the context in some ways about both of our learning journeys, as I like to call it, with Leicester, because we were there for different reasons. And there was one common friend and contact who thought that the two of us should meet. And our first trip was in the car, going around, driving, looking at factories from the outside in Leicester. My reaction was that this can't really be happening, because I have worked in factories, and the factories I have seen look different, feel different. And then we ended up standing at the platform.
You mean outside of the UK?
Outside of the UK. And I was, to be honest, as I've said it often, very surprised that, you know, we had these kinds of factories. And what I could not answer is, how are they allowed to sustain? That they exist is one thing, but that they have continued to exist hidden away, and sometimes not explicitly hidden away, was something which I think intrigued us. And then it was at the train station, I remember, when both of us were waiting for our respective trains, that we got talking. The question started with how we were ourselves being perceived by the local stakeholders, which then I would say kickstarted us into this journey. And I think the broader takeaway point in terms of the context of Leicester, and I think why we want to reflect on what it really means, is because it is situated in, you know, one of the global superpowers, has a rich history, has all kinds of developed infrastructure and a lot of metrics, you know, which you would see it does very well on that as a city. And yet there are these...
Like from a governance perspective, you mean?
From a governance perspective, yes. And yet there are these hidden away lives, these challenges, which I think is something worth thinking about and reflecting about.
All right. Jen, I want to turn to you. So you enter Leicester in 2020, I guess. I want you to elaborate. You know, you said that working in Leicester has been an experience that has challenged a lot of your assumptions. So I want to break that down. In 2020, when you, as you say, parachuted into Leicester, what ideas or assumptions or beliefs did you hold at that time about why human rights abuses were happening in Leicester?
To be honest, I didn't know. I had theories, but I didn't know. I knew that it had been an issue that people had been trying to solve for a long time. And one of my goals was to figure out why it hadn't been solved. But picking on from what Divya just said about our first meeting, I came into Leicester kind of armed with this messaging that there's a potential import ban of goods that are going to be manufactured in the UK into the US market. And this is going to have a huge negative reputational impact on not just Leicester, but the UK as a whole. And surely everybody's paying attention to this.
Yeah, everybody would care about that message.
Everybody would be not wanting this to happen in the UK. And they certainly wouldn't want their city to be associated with such an import ban. So why don't we just take this momentum that has been generated as a result of these petitions that have been filed and are now being investigated and use that as an entry point, a start of a conversation and to how we can see, okay, what's been tried, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and how can we maybe do things differently? And so I thought, well, this is a great way to open up that conversation and meet new people and kind of seeing what needs to be done. I remember when Divya and I first met, I think it was that same day, she kept asking me, now, why are you here? Explain again what the angle is. And I realized that there was an assumption that I had on my part that I just needed to explain. But there's the tariff act. Your goods are going to be banned and you're going to lose access to that market. That's going to financially be devastating to the brands and to the factories and reputationally damaging to Leicester and the UK as a whole. Surely we can all agree on that. And my first major learning point is that the words that I was saying were not relevant to the players on the ground.
It's so interesting to hear you say this because I've been involved like through a couple of other non-manufactured related projects that I've done about like creating an apparel supplier's guide to sustainability legislation in the US, the EU, and the UK that was sort of co-commissioned by a number of suppliers, most of whom are operating in the global south. And it's interesting because what you said almost verbatim sort of reminds me of conversations that we had within that project team when we were working on that resource, because it was like the same thing. They were reading all of this legislation and sort of trying to tease out what the implications would be practically for factories and for apparel producers globally to create a guide for, you know, what they should do. And it was really interesting because they were like, the more they read, the more they were like, oh my God, this is going to have huge implications, sort of like what you were just saying. And yet, the manufacturing associations themselves, most apparel producers that, at least as far as I can tell, and again, that's anecdotally, don't even really seem to have this on their radar. And when you talk to them, it's kind of like, maybe, yeah, it seems like a sort of peripheral issue, like not the main thing that they're interested in talking about. So it's interesting to me to sort of hear those parallels. So, but maybe you can continue. So this kind of fell on deaf ears. Here was this thing that happened that you thought was like a great opportunity to open the conversation, a great entry point, and people weren't interested. So where did you go from there?
Well, I came into it with an initial strategy, and that was to identify, recognizing not everybody's, you know, a bad actor, not all the suppliers are engaging in this kind of conduct. It's to identify the suppliers that are acting ethically and have good programs in place and are paying their workers the minimum wage, and sort of highlighting, singling those factories out, and with the idea that we could make the case that they should be exempt from the import ban. And this seemed to me like a good logical idea. So I just thought, well, the more people that know that this is a good strategy to become exempt from the import ban, then we can get some momentum and figure out what's working and what's not working. And I was working with two gentlemen who were just lovely and were some of the few manufacturers that were willing to speak to me at that point. And I had suggested a flyer. I said, well, we had to get the word out that this import ban is out there and exists. And so I drafted this, you know, flyer, and I thought, well, we'll just take it and we'll hand it out to every supplier, manufacturer. We'll just go around the area and let people know, and then, you know, invite them to come to a meeting and we can discuss what the import ban is, how it's going to affect them, and what they can do to avoid being impacted by it. I mean, I look back now and I just think how well-intentioned, but naive that strategy was. The gentleman, very polite and very patient with me. And I said, what will happen if I start handing out these flyers? And they said, they will throw them directly in the trash. And I said, well, why? like, they're not thinking about this. One, they don't want to be stick their heads above the parapet. They don't want to be singled out at all. And it's just not relevant. I don't even know whether our clothes end up in the U.S. market. The manufacturers don't know. They're just trying to get the orders in so that they can make payroll and make and meet their basic costs and expenses and get new production orders through. They're working on survival. They're not working on big picture planning. How are we going to reform the industry? And also, why should they talk to you? You are an American, a lawyer, I'm not even from the country. Is this just an example of, again, you know, developed countries having these ideas of what needs to be done to fix the problems? And I'm coming into this community and saying, here, these are the things that should be important to you, rather than actually listening to what was important to them. I guess it was like an aha moment for me. And I really started to change my approach.
When you say change your approach, what do you mean by that?
I think I just started to shut up and start listening. And that was a huge, once I stopped saying what I think what needs to take place and trying to get my agenda across, thinking that I'm doing the right thing to save the industry, because we all have good intentions. And if I just stopped and just started listening and just left it at that. And so I'd say like the first 6 months or so, once I realized that I don't have the answers and I don't know what's relevant and I don't know what messaging, I don't know how to get people interested and motivated, really identified that there's two groups whose voices aren't being represented. And the biggest one that came as a shock to me was the supplier community. There was no forum. There was no safety for them to get together and collectively push back on some of the unfair purchasing practices of the brands. And then the other forum that we actually knew nothing about was what the actual worker experience was. And so having identified that we don't understand those perspectives very well, and they're not represented in all the meetings that I've been going to, you know, in the multi-stakeholder meetings with brands and suppliers and charities and all that, none of those voices are being represented in those forums. I thought, okay, I'm going to focus on these two areas and just shut up and listen.
Hi. Sometimes I feel kind of like a madwoman sitting in my living room recording myself talk. If you want to help me with that feeling, share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on October 3rd to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link in the episode description. Fast forward a few years. And if I were to ask you the same question that we kind of started with, which is why are these human rights abuses in Leicester happening? When we started out with this conversation, you said, well, I wasn't really sure. It was one of the things I wanted to find out, but I had some theories, and I certainly, and tell me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but I certainly had ideas about how we should fix it, right? Or what would be sort of entry points into sort of galvanizing action around this. What would you say today? How would you answer that question now, a few years later?
Simply put, there are substantial inequalities across the garment industry supply chain. There are imbalances of risk, of power, of money, and that exists regardless of what country this is taking place in. It doesn't just exist over there. That same dynamic, it is part of the model of the fashion industry. And until we really look at why those inequalities exist and what the root causes of them are, we're not going to make any progress. The answer is Leicester is no different than any other garment industry issue anywhere across the globe. It comes down to inequalities of wealth and power and risk.
Yeah. Divya, I want to give you a chance to respond because I'm sure you have a lot to say, but I'll just share from my side, Jen, that this really resonates with me so much because I feel like when you started out, you shared that you came in with this idea that you would try and find the suppliers or the manufacturers who were like doing things in the right way, and you would try and like get them, you know, who had the right intentions and see if there was a way to get them exempt from this ban. And I'll just say for me personally, when I was working as a factory manager, I had this impulse also to sort of defend the company I was working for and to sort of talk about the company I was working for as one of these good guys, as one of these well-intentioned entities. And I knew at the time, too, that that was my impulse, that was my knee-jerk reaction, but I knew also that that was problematic, right? Because by sort of elevating myself and the company that I was working for in that way, I was sort of saying, well, then everybody else should be able to do it too. And I also understood that actually people face constraints, including ourselves. We also face constraints. And so to sort of put this emphasis on intention, well, we had the intention to be good guys. We had the intention that it sort of obscured the role of constraints. And my journey the last few years has really been about trying to articulate what, if we say, okay, intention is maybe relevant to a certain extent, but, you know, if you think about the whole spectrum or range of things that drive people's behavior, like intention is such a small sliver of that spectrum. And if that's where we focus, we kind of miss the elephant in the room, which is that I think, at least this is my personal view, that constraints are a far more powerful driver of behavior than intention, which then of course begs the question, well, what are those constraints? And it's interesting to use this word inequity, because I've arrived at the same conclusion. I think the biggest constraint is inequity. And I think you're absolutely right. The question that we then have to ask is, what are the causes of inequity? But Divya, I hand over to you.
I think there are so many aspects, but I'll just continue the chain of thought and conversation that you've just touched upon, which is, so constraints and inequity, and how do you then begin to talk about and deal with that inequity? And I think the insights which emerge from Jen's experience, and I think mine own actually, are to do about this word which Jen keeps using, listening. It's about understanding, because often, and this is something that we see in this industry ever so often, the initial reaction, if we try and understand that it is not our problem, then who is defining that it is a problem, right? Whose standards and whose norms are constituting the definition of the problem, and then you become a messenger of that problem, which is what Jen was. And today, fast forward, a point Jen hasn't mentioned is that for various reasons, for the last couple of months, she wasn't able to go back into Leicester to do the regular work she does with the community, and she was called back. She received a call from the local actor saying that, where are you? We need you. And there is a language barrier. We do not have, the organization does not have their translator. And yet, Jen is able to have those conversations, overcoming the limits of language and connect with people and offer them perspectives. So I think taking that away in terms of the question about whose problem is it, again, power and inequity kind of comes in. Who's defining, who's setting the agenda, who is, you know, talking about these issues. And I think resonates very strongly when you talk about your experience around legislation, that there are terms and terminologies, and often they are overwhelming, and you want to focus on the now to kind of somehow get up ahead.
On survival.
Exactly. The idea is, but you should be thinking about it, but who is the one who's saying should, right? Suppliers should be doing this, or workers should be thinking about this, but are they? And unless you build those relationships, that can't be.
But also, can they? It's as if, just because somebody says they should, and you can ask who should, like who's saying that they should, but also, even if there was awareness of that, can they? Like, or do they face constraints?
It kind of goes back to something that Jen and I kind of talk a lot about, because a lot of the work with Justice and Fashion now does is focused on working with workers and communities directly. Is this question of their own capability, or the term we use is capacity? It's the emotional capacity. It's the psychological capacity. What that has led me to is to kind of advocate and think about and talk to different actors, be in academia or practice, is this idea of a place-based approach in your engagement, where you kind of take away the abstraction of ideas or roles of people and kind of drill down to the sweat, blood, and tears. Acknowledge people as actors and their emotions.
Can you give an example of how that would work in practice?
I would invite Jen to just share, you know, what she does with the clinics that she runs.
The clinics that we've been running in Leicester for the last couple of years really did...
Legal clinics, right?
Well, that's exactly the point.
Okay.
There is a tendency, and I think, again, well-intentioned, that we're going to come in and we're going to help this community of workers understand and be able to exercise their rights. So How are we going to reach that community? How are we going to get them to talk to us so that we can help them? And all too often, almost exclusively, the strategy comes from, I want garment workers to come and tell me that they're being exploited so that I can call the brands out, or I can call the suppliers out, and we can let law enforcement know and expose this horrible travesty. So if I just show up and tell them, hey, I'm here to help you. If you're a garment worker, come here and talk to me. They're going to start talking to me. Why not? It makes sense. Again, that is our perspective. That is the top-down perspective of how the things are supposed to work. But that's not the reality, and certainly hasn't been the reality in my experience in Leicester. What we decided to do that was different is, one, I was just hanging out in the community a bit more. So my face became to be familiar. I became somebody that, you know, if you trusted this person, they said they would introduce them to me. And then they said, you can trust this person. So a little bit of that was just sort of hanging out. But then these clinics, and you asked, are they legal clinics? I'm like, no, they're not. They were there just to help anybody for any reason. So there were long queues at the outside of a community center where there was food distribution on certain days of the week. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people that queue for hours and hours in order to get a meal. And word sort of spread that there was this person here, that if you had any other issues, if you needed help with anything, come in and talk to Jennifer. And word spread so quickly that we exceeded our ability to meet with the people that were there. I mean, to a significant degree where I felt like we were really, really letting people down. We really tapped on a huge unmet need. We were not just looking to talk to garment workers. We weren't just looking to talk to hear stories about exploitation. As an example, one of the first women who came in to see me, her English was poor. She couldn't read or write in English, and her vision was poor, and she was eligible for a senior bus pass, but she couldn't apply for one because she didn't know how to fill out the forms. And so I helped her get her bus pass. In the process, saw that her right to remain in the UK was expiring in 2 months. And so after that sort of relationship and trust was built, then I could say, do you know that your right to stay in the UK is going to be expiring? Do you have a plan, or what are we going to do about this? Which opened up another area of her vulnerability that I wouldn't have known about. And then from there, the relationship kind of builds, because then you're working with them again. And then you learn about the exploitation that she's endured since her arrival to the UK in the fashion industry and beyond. And then that relationship enabled me to meet other people that she felt safe enough to introduce me to and hear their stories as well. And I think what this really does is it highlights the importance of investment in a community. Long-term, based on trust, and identifying what the most important things to the community is that is causing, could be contributing to them not feeling like they have the ability to exercise their rights when it comes to employment. If you could just take the amount of investment that goes into creating these laws and these codes of conduct and enforcement here, and, you know, we'll put this tariff ban up and we're going to put these regulations, and if all that investment that's taking place at this top-down approach is not going to go anywhere, it's going to land completely empty because we're not developing the bottom-up.
I want to shift to talking about the implications of this globally, because in a way, I think you've set us up for the perfect transition, right? Because when I talk to people who work on the brand and retailer side, and a lot of the people listening to this show are people who also work in sustainability roles, many of them either in NGOs or nonprofits or on the brand and retailer side, but anyway, in the quote unquote global north. And what you would hear, or what I would imagine it might be running through their minds, would be like, yeah, but how is a place-based approach scalable? This takes time. This takes investment, which fundamentally challenges, in my view anyway, the way that we structure global supply chains. Like, we can't solve these issues if we don't fundamentally rethink the way that we structure supply chains in the first place. But Divya, I'm going to hand over to you. What's running through your head?
This is a very, very powerful approach, but it is not easy, and it's very frustrating to get resources And I think that is largely because of what you just said, right? The global way and approach and the way the supply chain is structured. And I think that is another side of the reality, that while this organization, and I came across GIF while examining different organizations and different approaches, and I have worked in some before, that while this young organization has taken a very innovative and I would say a bold approach, it is very, very hard to actually sustain this effort. It's very frustrating at that level. And I think that is getting us to question maybe what is needed in terms of the global approach is a bit of a rethink. I mean, I would urge the listeners to think about when we have, and because this is a candid show, I'm just going to go candid. A lot of these funding organizations and agencies, they set priorities. And a lot of those priorities are, we are aimed and targeted at the global south. I think our approach should be defining the problems and the challenges in the supply chain and not putting geographic limits. And I think that is one of the, I would say, my motivation to kind of bring Lester to this podcast. In a globalized world, we need to deterritorialize when we are talking about defining the problem, because those problems exist as much as in the global north in various forms and shapes as much as in the global south. So one is the supply chain structure. And the other point, which was briefly touched upon, was just the very nature of the industry itself, which has propagated, you know, the challenges in Lester in various ways, because Lester filled a need of the market while, you know, Jen was talking about that there was competition as the markets opened up. There was competition which was coming in. One of the ways Lester remained sustainable, which saw the entire structure of the industry change, because you have much smaller firms with smaller number of workers versus, you know, the way the industry was set up in the future. So that changed because of the way the industry is prioritizing, you know, or looking at cost margins. But that is definitely something which must not be forgotten when we are looking at those issues. So I think being bold and innovative is also very risky. It has a personal cost. It has an organizational cost, which often is perhaps not necessarily acknowledged. And I think when we are thinking about the global implications and innovative approaches, I think what we need is maybe more safe spaces where we can actually trial out some approaches and make failing to some extent the norm, rather than chasing these are the outcomes. And maybe, you know, we redefine those outcomes. Maybe those are learning insights which emerge, which then help us scale up. So those are some of the thoughts which have been triggered because of some of the issues that you have raised.
It's interesting to hear you talk about like the sort of operational implications of being an organization that is trying to take a different approach, trying to sort of invest in a community, invest in listening. And it makes me reflect on my own experience. And I've talked about this a little bit on the show, actually in the last season, in a conversation that you were also part of, Divya. And for me, I mean, Jen, like my own approach, I think, and this is my own assessment, has been quite similar to yours in the sense that it hasn't been focused on necessarily a geographic place. For most of my time as a factory manager, I did not have a lot of contact with other factory managers or other people working on the factory side, other than people who were my direct vendors, my suppliers. And I had an experience shortly, like towards the end of my time as a factory manager, where I got to meet a lot of people who were working in sustainability on the factory side. And that was a very transformative experience for me, because up until that point, I kind of had thought that my experience had been exceptional. Then I had this chance to meet all of these other people who had been working on the factory side in mostly sustainability roles. So a little bit different to me, because I was really in an operational and a factory management role. And I realized that actually my experience didn't seem to be exceptional at all. That was a very like transformative moment for me, because after that, when I then did fast forward to 9 months later, or whatever it was, when I did leave my job as a factory manager, I kind of set out to like try and find out more about this community of people who seemed to have been having the same problems as me. I started to write about and to publish about my own experience. We also, together with Jesse, founded this podcast. And as a result of the content that we were creating, people sort of from that manufacturing community started coming to me and started saying, oh, I'm so glad you said this because this really resonated with my experience. And, you know, but I maybe didn't have the vocabulary to talk about it, or I wasn't in a position where I could talk about it. And most of these messages were private. And as a result of that, I ended up sort of within a network, a growing network of manufacturers. And I took the time to just talk and listen. And most of the projects that I'm involved in now sort of come out of those conversations and come out of the listening and the sort of open-ended nature of those relationships. But from a very operational point of view, how I then make my living is by managing the projects that come out of that. Because then I go and I say, okay, I have a group of manufacturers who are interested in doing a project on such and such, and I take it to various people who might be willing to fund it, and then we put together a project. And I have had to figure out a way to basically build the time and investment that it takes to develop those relationships and to develop them in sort of a meaningful and open-ended kind of way. I've had to figure out how to build that into the rate that I charge people for project management. So I think it's not even, Divya, to your point about should we be funding projects in Global South or Global North? I mean, yes, I think that's part of it, but I think it's even more broadly than that. How do we actually recognize the value that this brings? Because basically what I'm sort of saying right now is that, like, a lot of times that value isn't overtly recognized and I have to sort of like sneak it in other ways, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and you're, I would say, touching on a very important point again, that, you know, what is it that we value? Like, the whole narrative within our industry is that we need to change. There is a wider community which acknowledges that. But I think that change will not come by using the same sets of tools. I think what we need to think about is a bit differently in how we are doing things. And I think we've reflected on this previously. There have been various conversations, you know, in this show around the implementation approaches. And I think the narrative, again, when you are emphasizing on listening in your experience or in Jen's experience, is again going back to what we, I think, have had a discussion about, is this humanizing, right? It's bringing that human in and recognizing that those relationships take time and you cannot value it by the same matrices and have an output which is deliverable, which is perhaps a piece of document which maybe never gets read. But it's that experience and that engagement which is hard to capture. Maybe if our creative energies were invested in kind of redrafting, recrafting, and reorganizing that narrative, we might be able to make some sort of a headway, because the current toolkit that we have around achieving, again, in brackets, ethical production, it seems largely inadequate. And it's, there was, you know, and we, again, we often hear about it, the race to the bottom, right? That there's a displacement. But I think if you look at the core problems, I mean, it started in 2010, the first expose in Leicester, it's been 14, 15 years now. The same, you go to any other of the geographies, right? And you look at the issues, they are persistent chronic issues, which means that there is something that we are not addressing.
And kind of reflecting on the whole premise, the whole issue, that this is a result, a natural result of the inequalities of wealth and power. The ability to do anything about this exists with those who have the resource. And it makes sense that the protection of their interests would be the priority. So it would come from the codes of conduct, from the laws, from not wanting to be associated with modern slavery and the supply chain. And it makes sense that they want to show the world that they are the good guys. Where I think we really need to deconstruct this whole access to resource is demonstrating that taking that investment and putting it actually on the grounds, in the communities, understanding and listening to why are these people so vulnerable, and addressing those challenges from that perspective, rather than having to meet the needs of what the brand's interests are, just reallocating that resource to organizations that are truly there on the ground and are there for the long term and invest and build trust and learn and listen, because it can't be done. It's not as easy. It's not nice and simple, like ticking a box and not it. It requires investment and time. But I really do believe that what we have achieved in Leicester is scalable, and it's not unique to the garment industry either. It has to do with, what are these root causes? What are the root causes of vulnerability? What are the root causes of exploitation? And how are we going to make it a priority to start that investment with the communities, with the workers, and from the bottom up, because otherwise all this top-down stuff is just going to get lost. There'll be a huge gap in the middle.
So this is in a way a perfect segue, because the rest of this series is an exploration of what's happening in Leicester from different perspectives. We're going to talk to people who are working or work closely with factory owners. We're going to talk with government officials. We're going to talk with people who are working in close proximity with worker organizations or worker representatives. And Jen, I think a thank you is in order, because in many ways we've been talking about this unrecognized work and labor that goes into establishing these relationships and trust. And the reason that all of those people or any of those people are coming on this show is really, I think, a testament to the relationships and the trust that you have built. And now we are all, everyone listening to this show, I think will be reaping the benefit of that. Maybe I'll close by asking you, you know, is there anything you want listeners to keep in mind as they listen to the coming episodes?
Everybody has their lens and their perspective and their experience that they're bringing into this conversation. And the one that I'm bringing in is certainly kind of unique to me and deals with my legal background and desire to do the right thing. And I think it's important to understand that this is not bad people doing bad things across the sector. What we need to understand collectively, all of the voices that get represented in this program, is that we're all coming at it from a good place. We all have good intentions. I had great intentions when I came in to tell them about the Tariff Act. We don't want this stain on Leicester or the UK. But the important thing is that we recognize that there are no good guys and bad guys in this. So let's put our agendas aside. How are we going to address the problem collectively together, knowing that we all want the same outcome? It's a huge challenge. And like I said, not just in the garment industry, but across all sectors and globalization, supply chains and inequality. Divya?
Okay, so I have 2 points. I think one, I would request the listeners to actually think about what myths are being busted. What are the assumptions which are day-to-day activities in various aspects of the supply chain jigsaw that we function in, or even as observers and commentators of this industry? Which ones are being really exposed and questioned? So I think that is one invitation. And the other is that really the idea with this is to continue the conversation. So this conversation is something which I would say I had had with you, Kim, I had had with Jen, I had had with, you know, some of the other guests who are coming on the show. But the idea is really to think together. So it's an invitation for conversation. So, you know, reaching out, I would just say that's an invitation to, if anyone wants to delve deeper and reflect on some of these things with us, I think that is something which I would put out, because I think it would be powerful if more of us were to come together and to think about some of those issues which the case of Leicester or the conundrums in Leicester are exposing.
All right. Well, I think that's the perfect place to end. Thank you both for your time, your candidness, and honestly for making this happen, this idea for a concept for a show. And Divya, you're the first person who ever described Manufactured as a myth-busting show, and I'm looking forward to continuing to do that, but in this case, in the next few episodes, as it relates to Leicester.
Thank you for listening to Manufactured. I've been your host, Kim van der Weert, and if you learned something new from this episode and want to support the show, come say hi to me on LinkedIn. Also, share your musings, ramblings, or questions about this episode, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on the 3rd of October to debrief and compare notes about these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Links to the voice memo, community wall, and event registration page can be found in the episode description. And of course, subscribe, rate, and review us on the podcast app you're listening to this episode on.